Right, there was a hiccup with the video recording. So it works now perfectly. Welcome to the lecture number 3. The topic of the lecture today is the digital forensics process. We're going to talk about first 2-3 steps when it comes to collection of the data carriers, when it comes to extraction of the data, examination of the evidences, and what kind of things we would like to, let's say, to see on this step when it comes to police work, when it comes to first responders work. Also, I'm going to show a few demos related to Kali Linux. So I mentioned this before. Kali Linux is one of the fantastic tools used mostly in the penetration testing and ethical hacking community. I'm going to show a few relevant, let's say, software pieces that that you can use yourself. And also autopsy. So autopsy is another tool used to analyze images, used to analyze data in the specific, let's say, volume, specific partition. So it's up to you how you approach the analysis of the digital evidences. Before we begin, are there any questions about papers, projects, groups? I think most of you already sent me your preferences. So, but are there any questions? Yes, please. So our recommendation that the groups needs to be around, let's say, 5 members. They can be 6, they can be less. But if you could send me an email, then we can see what we can do about it. So it's usually not recommended that you work alone because, you know, if you need to present the paper and then you need to write a report yourself, it will be quite a lot of work. So that's why it's a group work. But please send me an email. If anyone online who join us today also has any troubles with groups, please shoot me an email and we'll try to figure out the solution for you. So today is the deadline for selection of the paper that you're going to present in the group and also the project area, the project domain. The next deadline that I will mention will be 20th of September, and there you need to submit more specific project description, project proposal. All right, I hope you already got the book. I mentioned it a few times, but I still recommend that you start reading the books and the chapters that I put in this table. It's important that you read through the chapters because the book is quite intensive. You can't really, you know, read it in a few days before the exam, so it's very important to start as early as possible. Also, most likely the lecture number 4 will be moved to the week after, so I'm going to post more information, so most likely there won't be any lecture next week because we have a clash with the department meeting, so I'm going to post, so we're going to see it also in the calendar for the course. So I hope you, all of you started reading the papers. So you'll need to present your particular paper that you selected, like P3, P4, P5, but also you need to read all of them because some of the questions might be from the papers that we uploaded. The deadline is topic selection for the project and for the paper today. I think I got 3 local groups, 8 remote groups, and 4 experience-based groups who send me the topics. So this is a good result. But if you have some challenges, I know that some of you online and cannot find a group to work, please talk to me. And you'll need to send me the your selection in this form, like the group, ID, topic, and the project topic. So the guest lecture, as I mentioned, next week it might collide with another meeting, and the guest lecture about the malware will be moved to the week after. So we'll have the presentation, I think, the same day as the lecture. That's the approximate or tentative plan for the guest lectures, those who confirmed. We probably will also have a lecture from Antonio Sok, Security Operations Center here in Jovik, but this will come later in September, October. The paper presentations. You'll need to prepare about 10, 15 minutes presentation of the topic that was, let's say, written in the paper. You know, the methodology, what are the findings, what are the results of the paper, what kind of things you think can be improved, and maybe there are new technologies, new approach. So 10, 15 minutes presentation of the paper. I'm going to create hand-in folders in Blackboard. So it's expected that you deliver the paper. So you select the paper ID and you deliver by the corresponding deadline video to hand-in folder. So we won't have the in-class presentations as before, but it's a mandatory thing that you need to deliver also for completion of this course. The course book, so Digital Forensics Process, is the first part. Also, the next lecture will be about the later part of the Digital Forensics Process. We're going to talk about how to represent the data, how to compose everything that has been found during the investigation, and so on. So one of the last administrative announcements, we still need to have the reference group. So I'm repeating this one more time. Please volunteer for the reference group. I know that we got one member from the experience-based cohort. So if anyone locally in Jovik or is a part of a remote cohort who would like to be part of the reference group, please shoot me an email. So it's very important, because otherwise we'll need to employ the intelligent AI random-based generator to select the volunteers. It's just a requirement from Antonio, so that we have a communication channel to students that if something needs to be improved, then it's the, let's say, the gateway to student opinion. And it's no more than a few hours workload during semester. Plus, you can get a certificate of participation from Hilde Bakke if you need it for your CV. So today's lecture will be about the digital forensics process. It's related to identification, collection, examination, analysis, and there will be also analysis and presentation next week. So there will be a short demo. I'm going to show you Kali Linux, and also you will see the video on Blackboard about autopsy, how to use particular functionality from the autopsy, how to, let's say, employ particular, let's say, stages when you want to make a reporting, because first stage, you import image of the hard drive into the autopsy, you analyze, you explore, sometimes keyword search, sometimes more e-discovery, and then you select what you want to include in the final report. It's a very powerful tool, and in general, Cellebrite Reader and Autopsy and SluiceKit, they became extremely powerful, so you can connect, anything like, for example, hashes of known to be good, hashes of known to be bad files, so that you can get red flags that, maybe you have a malware there, and then you can exclude files that are standard, for example, executables and libraries in Windows, because you don't need to analyze those files. They're standard in every Windows. So we're going to talk about approaches in this lecture, because the point also to minimize the load as much as possible when you analyze the data on the image of a hard drive. So you don't need to analyze maybe 100 gigabytes. Instead, you need to look through one gigabyte, for example. So it just, it can be quite short, let's say, workload in comparison to the whole data set or the whole drive. Right, so there are five stages. It's just one of the examples of the digital forensics process. Of course, you can find different types and different modification of such process. Like, for example, going to digital forensics research workshop. It's one of the most famous conferences for industry academia. They have it in Europe. They have it in US. And if you look at the publication of that workshops, you will find that through like 20 years, they publish so many different variants, like 5 steps, 8 steps, 10 steps, 16 steps. It depends on the technology, it depends on the application, it depends on the operating systems. So it's quite a big variety of things to choose from. Normally, when we talk about the digital forensics process, there is a general understanding that there need to be steps like identification, like what kind of things we collect. It can be data carriers, flashcards, HDDs. How do we acquire? So we need to have some kind of devices to extract. It can be a chip off. So we'll have a lecture from a colleague who works in Kripos also. He'll talk about more practical things related to hardware extraction of the data. Examination, how do we find the evidences? Like, right, we got the DD image from a hard drive. What's next? Like, do we know what's the operating system was installed? Do we know what's the file system was there? Do we know what kind of files? Do we have any encrypted partitions? So it's more about analysis of needs, let's say, of the extraction of the data. Analysis, so we need to create a hypothesis. As I mentioned, you will also learn about this in the lab week during the week 40, where you need to look into what kind of things you you expect to find. Is it a economic crime case, like Økokrim is handling? Like, maybe you need to look for spreadsheets. Is it a case where a web server was hacked? Maybe we need to look for some traces of the pen testing software, of traces that the website left in the browser history, and so on. So the analysis and the presentation is the final step where we put everything that was found during the whole digital forensics process in a understandable and repeatable format. Because everything that will be presented later in the court of law needs to be reproducible. So you cannot say that you randomly picked a file and that contains all of the evidences of economic crime. There has to be a methodology. So the methodology needs to be developed in a way that you do it once, you get the result. You do it 10 times, you get the same results. So it has to be repeatable and deterministic. So we'll go through the whole chain of this generic process. As I mentioned, there are a lot of different types of the processes. You can find it on Digital Forensics Research Workshop, their publications over the last 20 years. But this is also a spiral model. So it means that, we go through the whole process, we come to the final point, we realize that, well, there was another laptop connected to the network. So we acquire that laptop and we start again. So it's not, the finite kind of process, but it's more like a repetitive process. So the first part of the process, digital forensics process, is how we can ensure that we're doing this thing in a correct order. If we get a laptop running with the operating system, like, for example, Windows, and we got a suspect that was using this laptop, and we first thing that we do is turning off the laptop, then probably we need to repeat it again under normal circumstances that requires first looking at, you know, what kind of programs there. Can we unlock the laptop if it's locked? Can we see if there are any network traffic and things like this? So it's very important to have a not just a reproducible process, but also the process that follows a certain defined steps. Let's say there is a quality assurance process that, you know, like if we do it in this way, then most likely we'll get all evidences that were on the data carriers. And there is no push button forensics. So there is no tools that you just press the button and get fantastic results like in the movies. It's usually about the person that is doing analysis of the data, their qualification, their certifications, their experience. So the more experience a person has, the bigger chance of getting right pieces of evidences. So, as I mentioned, this has been developed for many years, and also it is generic enough to be applicable in many many cases, depending, you know, on the type of the crime. It can be just purely computer crime. It can be a crime where the ICT technologies were used to target a certain infrastructure, like, for example, it can be fraud, espionage. It can be computer intrusion, it can be murder investigation, it can be enterprise incident like intellectual property theft, financial disruptions, and so on. So technically, the process that you find in this course is applicable to multiple, generic enough and applicable to multiple crimes out there. And as I mentioned, there is a difference between the crime and incident. So crime is on the side of the police investigation. So there are a set of laws that police need to abide. There is a set of proceedings, rules, the way how they handle the data, the way how they store, where they store, how they process, and so on. Incident, this is more civilian setting where usually it happens in the company. For example, there was something, you know, that breached the corporate policy. So it can be just an error in the computer system that caused such incident. They can be insider threat. They can be external manipulation and attack. So nevertheless, it's a completely different scenario that, of course, can follow the digital forensics process to figure out what happened and how to prevent and how to resume the operations. But it does not guarantee that, you know, this case will end up in a court of law. And in most cases, you will see that the digital forensics process in general is applicable to different domains of let's say, computer systems. It can be Android phones, you know, it's the same. You have tools to extract the data, you have tools to chip off the memory, for example, NAND memory, and everything that is on the PCB. You have the computer, you have, for example, Windows machine, Linux machine, Apple. It's also applicable to, you know, more smarter things like tablets, smart applications, Internet of Things, and so on. So you have a wide range of devices that you can analyze using these guidelines, the generic guidelines. But of course, the tools will be different because you can't really use, you know, autopsy probably to analyze, you know, a specific connected phone. Instead, you need to use Cellebrite Reader for the mobile applications and mobile phones. And of course, there are a lot of innovations, and on every step, you will see this innovation in included in the tools. Like I mentioned, artificial intelligence, and usually it's the text analysis, to some extent also image and patterns analysis. When, you know, you open autopsy or you open Cellebrite Reader, and you can see already, you know, the characteristics of the objects that are on the pictures on this particular device. So that's an example. Of course, we have the conventional keyword search, e-discovery, that are rather trivial applications, but they help to narrow down the amount of data that need to be investigated. Also, in the aforementioned tools, you'll find appliances like, for example, the known files hashes, so that you can exclude, or the opposite way, you can include it in the report that we know that there was a computer Trojan in that particular folder. Or, for example, there was a certain program, like how to hack a web server, for example, application. So that also can be included in the report. The digital forensics process has multiple subtasks that are data-driven. So it usually relies on the data. It can be correlation, it can be file carving, it can be extraction of the deleted files from the particular image of a disk. It can be, correlation of events in the timeline. It can be using the open source intelligence, like, for example, VirusTotal, if we have some suspicious files and we think that, there might be some clues, we can query VirusTotal using API, for example, and we can get, more information about the files if those files are to be found in the VirusTotal. If not, then we need to look for MD5 hash sums online. We need to look for the file names and so on. So there are a lot of sub-operations that require, putting these pieces together in the complete picture. And it needs to be reproducible. Like if you're looking for a MD5 hash sum online and you find it in one of the websites, it's good that you take a screenshot, for example, and you record when this screenshot was taken, because at some point, the website might disappear. So the overall goal is to maximize the chance that we will get all relevant evidences that are to be found on the disk, that everything that we use in terms of resources and the time frame, it's on the minimal level of resources that can be used, because we can spend 1 year, 30 people working on some criminal case, but in the end there is no clue, and there are no hypotheses beside those that were established initially. So it's very good to focus on the quality. Quality means also, the time and the resources spent. And that's why I'm mentioning that, in those tools you will see a lot of supplementary functionality like filtering, search, full text search, e-discovery, text recognition, image recognition, files carving, so that you can reduce this complex problem to kind of manageable problem that can be perhaps tackled by a single person. There was a case described in the book when the prosecutor requests dismissal, and it's not because it's too much evidence, but it's too much data. So often happens that a police precinct cannot really handle the data, all possible data. They don't have resources. And they cannot really, get more resources than, could be possibly done in the particular crime investigation. So it's not possible sometimes to limit, the scope or limit amount of data because it's huge. So that's why sometimes, it's only focus on relevant data and possibly those that have pieces of evidences, but of course there is no guarantee. Handling the data from huge cases like Enron data set, it's actually an example of fraud in the organization, but in the end of the day the data set is kind of manageable, so those emails that they released, it's manageable. It's called Enron. And using the tools will put us in this kind of scale where we need to, accept or discard a certain hypothesis that, it's the slide from the previous lecture, but you'll see the difference in how we accept a certain hypothesis depending on the on the data that we process. So it might be that we just don't get enough resources and time to process all the data to get the right hypothesis in place and to get the supporting material for such hypotheses. So there are two requirements when it comes to the data, because it's the data-driven approach or the digital forensics process. There is a strong need to follow the chain of custody. So it means that, we have this step-by-step approach. It's documented. We can establish the accountability, meaning that we know what was done on each step, who did it, like who had access, what kind of things were found, and so on. And the evidence integrity. It's a very important task to ensure that, for example, the moment that we take in we seize the phone, and the moment when we analyze and present it later, the data remains the same. There is no change to data. Of course, from the previous lecture, it can be done using cryptographic hash like MD5, SHA-1-2-3, whatever you can use. But the point is to ensure and validate that the data here and the data in the end of the process, they're the same. There is no change. And this can be validated by taking hash sum in the beginning and then later in the presentation stage when, we need to show that it's the same data. So the overall digital forensics process must adhere to the practices and guidelines that have been established in the community. There has to be a reproducible and, let's say, deterministic process. We can't do any random components there. We can't just, pick a random file and say that this file might be relevant because we think so, because we like the name, because it was a big size or something. So there has to be a scientific justification of every step that we do. Like, for example, I will talk later about Daubert standards. It's mostly used in US system, legal system, when one needs to establish that the tool, like autopsy, sluice kit, that we use has unknown errors or irregularities, so that if we look for two keywords in the search field, then we might get zero results, or some other cases when the tool produces erroneous output. So we need to know also that all algorithms implemented using certain programming language in the tool, they are deterministic. So there won't be cases when you get different results while running analysis using same tool, same data, maybe on different laptops. So the idea in the whole digital forensics process is to limit the scope. As I mentioned, we need to cut the whole data portion to a smaller set of possibly files or fractions of files that are relevant. So it means that, these are the facts, these are the pieces, evidences. We need to be able to remove with the high degree of confidence all other files, like, for example, Windows DLLs. They are irrelevant. We don't really need to analyze them. And then must be capable of being scrutinized by the judiciary if the results of the analysis is presented later in a court of law. So it needs to be validated. There has to be, for example, expert witness that justifies, explains how it's done, how the analysis has been done, why the method or the tool produced a certain output and not the other output. So it's a lot of about the credibility of process and the results of this process. So the identification, according to RACE 2002, the task to detect, recognize, determine the incident or crime to investigate. So when the crime or the incident happened, we need to understand what happened, what's illegal, what kind of incident is that, what happened. We need to be able to narrow down the, let's say, the event itself, like what happened particularly. And in the organization, if you get one event, it can be a random glitch in the hardware, software, a bug. It can be something like, the misconfiguration of the IDS policies, just somebody put a comment sign in the wrong place. It can be, insider threat. So it happens like every week or more. But if you see the regularity of such events, disruptive events, then probably it's not a random thing that happened, but it's rather some kind of malicious action. So it needs to be investigated and it needs to be analyzed. It's also about training or preparing for the incidents. We'll be talking about the digital forensics readiness or also preparedness. It's the process of ensuring that we have logs in some remote location, that we have all important data, that we have, for example, logs from the IDS and host systems that can validate, all right, there was a computer virus on that particular system, so we need to start from there. So it's about like preparing and also the training both in the enterprise IT setting and in the police case. Needs to be a certain person that knows how to respond to the to the incident. So the incident can be categorized or described in different forms, different words, but technically if something that happened that is out of normal, so the person, for example, reports that I have a laptop, I don't touch a laptop, but there is a cursor that moves on my laptop. So there can be that, the frequency of the mouse coincided from somebody else's laptop, so just, an imaginary explanation. But it can be also that somebody get a remote access, remote desktop access. So in that case, there has to be a person that knows what to do. If you go to IT, they normally know how to handle the incidents. They have certain like procedures. They have guidelines what to do. Like you need to isolate if it's connected to the NTNU network. We need to look into logs, monitor the network if there are any other activities. What's the access pattern? What's the IP addresses used in that laptop? And so on. So it's a lot about the training. We also need to be aware of different technologies, as I mentioned, and different things that you can find. For example, on this picture, what kind of digital data carriers you can identify that can possibly store information? Anyone? Yes. Laptop, perfect. We can use laptop to store the data. So that's the main source that we need to approach. And it's, let's say, this is piece of hardware that is more, obvious. So it's something that is very obvious. Yes. Let's see the calculator. Yes. So the calculator here. It might be because sometimes you get, more advanced calculators that can store things. You can also place a micro SD card, right, into the calculator under the battery compartment cover. So it can be also something. Yes. Yes. So it might be that you'll get the USB drive. They can be very small. It can be hidden. Which one? Let's see, this one. So this is a standard thing that you'll get on the conferences. they usually kind of mass produce these types of hard drive, the USB sticks. Anyone else? Yes. CD, perfect. So CD, 700 megabytes, but still some data. Yes. Once again? This one. Yeah, smartphone. It's I don't know the model and the type of the smartphone, but it looks like it can store some gigabytes. Yes. Which one? This one. Yes. It looks like a small kind of PC or something. Yes. In the charger. Yeah. What kind of charger? Oh yes, right. So it also can be an option if you use like micro SD, you know, charger or something that can be, I know, kind of tuned, fine tuned. Right. Anyone else? Yes. Exactly, and that's the problem because it can be so small that, you know, like it can be virtually like anywhere. You can put it in the clicker, you know, like it's a small thing here. Any other ideas? Yes. Smart glasses. You mean this one? Well, yeah. Why not? Why not? There was, you know, a period like 8-10 years ago that the Google Glasses came and people were using them. So it was, why not? There might be some pictures, you know, data. Any other ideas? This one. Yes, so that might be it, like one-time code generator. So it also might give an indicator that maybe there is a customer of a specific bank. So it's a very good point. You can probably see also there is a hard drive. So this is our hard drive, right? Yes. This one, so this is DVD-R, I think. Yeah. So it's a good point, exactly. So it might be something that, you know, can be relevant. But otherwise, very good brainstorming. You can see that, you know, just a simple office workplace, but so much data and so many different types of devices can be extracted and, you know, analyzed. But just imagine all of the things that we mentioned. If one person comes and he or she needs to analyze all this data and, you know, first of all, find a right reader, like for USB stick, no problem. For CD, DVD, how many of you have laptops with CD and DVD reader? Right, so no one is using basically. It's so difficult to find a laptop now, you know, like modern laptop that you can use to check the content of CD and DVD. It's like, you know, the floppy disks. Any of you try to use the floppy disk? Oh, wonderful, wonderful. It's way before. But what's interesting, in some countries, in the critical infrastructure, they still use those. Because they have systems that cannot be put offline. And as soon as it works, they use the floppy disk, 1.44 megabyte. Right, very good. Very good brainstorming. This picture kind of demonstrated, you know, the whole range of devices, things where you can hide the digital data, because consider the digital data as something that is very relevant to our case. And we don't know, you know, if that particular micro SD is relevant. But maybe if it's hidden in some other device, maybe it might be relevant because there is a a reason why the micro SD has been hidden. It also depends, like at home, just imagine your home, like, all the CDs, DVDs, all the USB sticks, micro SD, NAS, USB HDD, just 3.5 or 2.5 inches hard drives, they might be in different drawers, they might be in different, rooms. So it's less order. And then when we go to small businesses, small, medium enterprises and large businesses, they have usually a very thorough routine buying hardware, assigning the ownership of the hardware, the maintenance of the hardware, who is the data custodian, for example, what are the policies, where the data is stored. It's either on the laptop or some server or in the cloud. And then also decommissioning the hardware, so it's the whole process. It's usually a bit easier to handle, things and procedures in large organizations. And usually, as I mentioned, or as you could see on that picture before of the office environment, it's just something that we can see. It's only things that we can, see, and they are obvious to us. But imagine how many things that are not obvious, like it can be a corporate network-attached storage, it can be a cloud, it can be a file-sharing service that, the person working in this office been using. The person might have access, to darknet through Tor browser. There might be, some accounts locked or, let's say, connected to the computer. So it's a lot in the cloud, and especially now when the cloud is so popular and used by everyone, by all organizations, we have this big challenge to extract all of the data. So think about it. Maybe all of the data carriers, they represent only, 10% of the data that person actually had access to. So that's the challenge, that it's not just physical thing. Another aspect is the technology, and the technology in the sense that it can be different layers of abstraction. I'm not talking here about, for example, virtualization, virtual machines. Like cloud is a purely virtualization, virtualized environment. It can be nested virtualization. It's also RAID 6. Sometimes, when you get the computer, you think that all of the hard drives contain, a specific partition, and you need to, turn off the laptop or the computer and extract all data from the partitions. In a matter of fact, it might be that it's a RAID. How many of you know what is RAID? Perfect. And how many are actually using it? Very good. Very good. I'm using it myself, and I recommend to use it because sometimes you get the data, critical data, on the hard drive, and then once in a while the hard drive fails. Like there was a server here actually at NTNU that had RAID 6, and one day I discovered that actually the hard drive failed. But we didn't lose any data because, the way how the RAID system works, it distributes the data, let's say, pieces and data blocks, in a sense that if one hard drive fails, then you can just replace this hard drive and you're good to go. You won't lose any data. So why I'm describing this? Because something that you can see in the laptop on the computer system might have a certain level of abstraction of technologies that you don't really know. So the RAID can be hardware. So you will see on the motherboard, please connect the hard drive 1 and hard drive 2 for RAID 1 mirroring, or for RAID 0 stripping, for example, model. It can be also software. So if you pull a hard drive, you will just get, some pieces of the data that are unreadable. You won't get, the whole picture. So that's the point where, it's usually more information or more complexity of the technologies than you can find and that you can, see at the first glance. Another thing that you probably will find on most of the laptops, like this one, it's the technology that locks let's say, hard drive to the particular laptop that has this technology, right? So, for example, I go to BIOS, I install the password that only I know, and then somebody takes the laptop and extracts the hard drive and tries it, for example, in the laptop from other manufacturer like Acer, I don't know, Lenovo. It won't work because, first of all, you need this layer of technology that gives access to the hard drive through the encryption mechanism embedded in this laptop by the manufacturer. So it can be way more complex. It also can be a variety of shared resources like SMB, Samba. There are a lot of, you know, things related to the fact that when a person comes to the organization, they usually have shared folders, a lot of shared folders. It can be a shared folder as a drive. You can just find it in my computer. Or it can be a certain program like Dropbox, you know, that you need to access a certain layer of infrastructure. And of course, you need to make decision whether the technology or the device needs to be turned off. As I mentioned, just think about RAID, because sometimes you need actually operating system to function properly, like Ubuntu. They have the LVMs, they have, you know, technologies like, for example, JMirror, and you need actually a system, a Linux kernel to function and to be able to open the data on the RAID. What if it's a laptop or a mobile phone? You need also to provide access to electricity, because, you know, you might have a mobile phone that has some kind of application open that has very important information, but then the phone is locked. So you can provide, you know, power bank that will power this device with the hope that, you know, you might be able to unlock the device, like using Cellebrite tools I mentioned in the first lecture. So it's not obvious at the first glance. You know, it might be that the computer is compromised and there is an ongoing attack. There are, like, data leaking somewhere, somebody is, you know, extracting the data. So in that case, maybe you need to switch it off because it's critical. But if it's a police investigation, then first of all, you need to extract what's in the memory, so order of volatility. Have you heard about Faraday bags? Right, so that's the technology, or it's not a very specific model that you use, but it's just a general concept that has a certain bag or a box that is very isolated, I mean, from the electromagnetic emission, so that, you know, the device cannot communicate to other radio frequency protocols like, you know, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, 4G, 5G, I don't know, NFC, iButtons, whatever you can imagine. So it's usually something that isolates on the level of radio frequency communication. And of course, you know, there is a question on the opposite side. What if the device is off? Should you switch it on? Because sometimes you'll get to the crime scene and you'll see that devices are, you know, switched off completely. So it depends. There is a need to identify, first of all, data carriers, identify devices, you know, and see what's on the device. So usually if you have the device switched off, maybe, first of all, you make a read-only copy of the hard drive. And then once you have it somewhere in the safe storage, you start the device, because technically the data are already in the safe storage. It's just that, you know, there might be some runtime information available that you might need to use later. And it depends also on the cases. If it's, you know, for example, missing person case, the priority is to find the person. The priority is not to preserve the evidence. You know, you need to use all resources to find the person. So it's also, you need to consider a fire investigation. So like the fire brigade is there to put out the fire, But the earth and evidence preservation, it's not exactly, you know, the point. So they need to save people who might get hurt because of the arson. But all the evidence is, you know, they don't really care that if some of the computers in the room will be wet because of the water. The point is to, you know, remove the threat to life. And the same with ideas. Often, you know, recovery and business continuity is the main priority and not, you know, why or who did it. So, of course, it's important, but first we need to restore and we need to continue the business as usual. And then we look into how it happened and how we make sure that, you know, it won't happen again. So identification and also you will see, for example, the chain of custody in many of the tools when it comes to reporting. So the chain of custody is all the metadata or documentation of the digital forensics process. Like normally you need to write a report, like the name, the rank, the date, the timestamp, you know, if there is an MD5 hash sum of the hard drive, you know, everything will be put there, like what kind of tools, versions of the tools, systems used, and then you write a report, you know, like what's the approach that been used, what are the data found, what are the tools, maybe what is the functionality in the tool that been used. The advantage of autopsy is that all of this data, you know, can be collected automatically. So everything that you use in autopsy, all the modules, for example, like Ingress, if you're looking for known files, if you're looking for some, like, you know, viruses, in the end of the process of the digital forensic process, you can put it in the PDF file or HTML file, and it will be available to anyone who will be reading. So it really simplifies the procedure of analysis. And of course, you know, the log files, for example, logbooks, it's everything that will be included. It's called the Laboratory Information Management System, LIMS, and it's very helpful because, again, it simplifies the life in a sense that you don't need to do it yourself. You just click the buttons, like what are the files you want to include in the report, what are the procedures or operations that you did in the tool to find those files. So when you select everything, you tick the boxes, it will go into the final report, and it will be quite extensive. So you can include anything, you know, part of the files been found, maybe strings that been in the file that you also extracted, and you can put it in the final report. So anything can be placed there. So the collection, it's the next step, is basically meaning of acquisition and extraction, because once we identified, you know, all relevant data carriers and devices, we need to acquire or extract, you know, everything that can be relevant. Like, for example, we got the USB stick. Is it a really, you know, a USB stick? Maybe it's just a kind of a toy that doesn't have anything. Can we get the data out of the USB stick? Maybe it's empty. Why it's empty? Maybe all of the data been deleted, or there is a glitch, so we can't see the data. The HDD that we pulled from the workstation, you know, is it just a simple NTFS system from Windows machine? Can it be, you know, a Linux machine? Is it a macOS machine? Was it part of RAID 0? If it was part of RAID 0, we need, you know, a second hard drive, and we need also this hardware software level to extract the data. So it can be very, very complex scenario, but we need to analyze and we need to identify what is relevant. I think we can make a 5 minutes break just to refill the coffee, let's say 15, 17, and then we start again. So welcome back. We're talking about collection. So as I mentioned, it's all depends also on the technology. When you get the hard drive in hands, is it really just, you know, a file system there? Maybe it's some kind of level of abstraction that you know, you need to get. Also, different devices like phones, you know, sometimes the speed of the interfaces in the phones are quite slow, so it means that we need a lot of time, you know, to extract it. What if it's you know, just SATA 1 or ATA, for example? It's something that can be very slow, so it means that for us we need to understand, you know, this time span to get all the data. So as I mentioned, you know, it's not just the technology, but also, let's say, the layers that we found. So the layers, it can be hardware, it can be software, it can be cloud layer, it can be any type of abstraction, you know, it can be encrypted partition, it can be protected partition, it can be logical, for example, partitions that are spanning across multiple hard drives, physical hard drives. So a lot of challenges when it comes to understanding of the data and structure of the data. And then, you know, like, it's not just this, but then also later in the stack when we want to extract some kind of file system, can we really do it? Do we have a tool that supports this file system? And then can we recreate volumes? Can we mount these volumes, you know, the logical, for example, volumes, the primary volumes, and the swap partitions? There can be, you know, some traces in the swap partitions. So it's all related to the stack of software and hardware used by the person who's being investigated. So sometimes, you know, it's not that easy to as it may look at the first glance. So once we found the way to extract and, you know, at least mount the partition, first of all, we need to do it in a very careful way so that we don't overwrite or we don't change any data. It's usually, like in Linux, you'll see it with Jeff. You'll use mount command, and then you specify that you just need read-only access. So you can view the files, you can view the, you know, the file system, but you cannot change anything. You cannot delete, you cannot modify, you cannot write new file. And then you do a copy, because it's easier, you know. If you have a copy, you can change the file, you can delete it all. Anyway, you will have a copy, because it's a digital copy, right? You can make as many copies as possible, but it's something that helps to make sure that you don't change the original data. Another challenge when it comes to digital forensics process is the new technologies and so many different, you know, technologies out there. Doorbells, drones, e-bikes, IoT, you know, all type of things that we can imagine. It's usually some kind of interface that each of the devices have. Right. So, for example, the easiest one is the TTL JTAG USB that you will find, you know, in various formats. You'll find in you know, in various ports, types of interfaces. It might be I2C, you know, UART connection. So anything that can be connected. And in some of the cases, you know, as I mentioned, you know, in IoT guest lecture, you will be able to get actually some data. So if you connect this, for example, this device to Raspberry Pi that is running, or you connect this device to some kind of a smart gateway, you know, or a drone that has a JTAG, that has I2C, that has UART connection. And it's very simple. It's usually four pins. You get ground plus five. Then you have TX and RX for transmission and receiving, you know, the communication. Then you need to select your speed. It's, for example, 9600. that is commonly used. And then if you're lucky, you'll get the output from the device. In some of the cases, those ports like JTAG, they're left intentionally on the board so that, you know, the manufacturer can debug. Sometimes the manufacturer forgot to close those ports, so everything that the device generates will be available to you to understand and even perhaps get a you know, some kind of a dialogue window that you can interact. It's also, you know, the opposite, the old technologies. The old technologies, it's not a challenge, it's a problem often. Because if you go to labs, like Digital Forensics Lab in Kripos, in Ökokrim, they all have big capabilities. So they all have, for example, a huge suitcase with 100, 200 different connectors to different phones used over, you know, all like 2-3 decades. So that if you get, for example, Sony Ericsson K710i, which was popular around 2007-08, you still will be able to get the data because the phone was able to store the data. Nokia 3510, it's this special connector. You know, now it's easy. It's Type-C or micro USB that was before. But if you look back like 10, 20 years ago, every manufacturer try to do their own port for charging, for extracting the data, you know. And even the same manufacturer like Nokia, you know, like Sony Ericsson, they had devices that were incompatible if you want to charge, like, charge, for example, one phone with the charger from another phone. So now it's, like, no problem whatsoever. We use the Type-C that is de facto standard that can charge, you know, 5 volts phones. It can also charge, for example, 19 volts laptops. So it all depends on the specification, but it's a wide range and quite convenient. So the old technology will create a lot of problems. Like if you're giving, you know, the floppy drive, you know, just think where you can possibly find FDD reader, the device that reads this floppy disk, right? Like myself, maybe I have one, you know, floppy reader at home. Maybe not. So it's always, you know, about these technologies that were kind of replaced. But if you get to extract the data from this technology, you know, from this floppy disk, it will be a nightmare to find it. So dead and live systems, as I mentioned, sometimes you'll get phones or laptops that are possible to turn on, and then you can unlock if you have a PIN code or a fingerprint. Sometimes somebody used, you know, a nail and a hammer and just, you know, put it in the phone. Of course, most likely you won't be able to power it. Maybe the battery exploded. Maybe you damaged, you know, some part of the boards. But there is a huge likelihood that actually you can still extract the chips. Because if you can extract the chips, and there is no super complicated hardware attached encryption, then there is a chance also to get the data. And everything that, you know, that's out of reach, like cloud, social media, you know, it's not possible to ensure that you'll get, let's say, the full credibility in extracting those data, because the things like, imagine a Facebook feed, you saw some picture in the post, you know, you think that this can be used, and it can be relevant to an incident, can be used for the crime investigation, and then you come back 1 hour late and the post is deleted, right? So it's so agile and dynamic system that the only way to, you know, to preserve this evidence is to make maybe screenshots. So this is why I mean that, you know, it's so alive and so complex. Now, to preserve the evidence integrity, as I mentioned, integrity is one of the key points that kind of helps to ensure this quality of the process, of the digital forensics process, and it helps to control that, you know, the data that we have on the phone from the moment that when the police comes and to the moment when it's presented in a court of law is the same data. You know, ideally we could have, you know, the hash sum of each file and demonstrate that it's the same file, but normally just the hard drive is being copied with the read-only permission, and then the MD5 hash sum is taken before the copy and, for example, after the copy to ensure that, you know, there were no mistakes in the copying process. And as you know, the MD5 is broken, so you can't really use it to sign the documents, because there have been examples when, you know, you can create another document with the same hash sum. But for integrity control, it's something that is used a lot, and in most of the tools you still will be able to see the MD5 hash sum for the validation. So it means that, you know, even though in the critical applications it's not recommended to use MD5, because, you know, you can find another file that has the same, for example, hash sum collision attack. But for you know, this particular hard drive, you can still, you know, use, or for the file, because MD5 is still used to find, for example, viruses, a computer malware. Like you get the MD5 of a particular file, and then you try to look it on VirusTotal. So it's still used, and I think it will be used for some time. Now, the collection, the order of volatility, I mentioned that, you know, some of the data, if the system is running, some of the data need to be collected in the first place. If the computer is running, you cannot just, you know, turn it off, make a copy of the disk, and then turn it on. So it doesn't work like this, and you'll most likely damage every possible, you know, process and data, or the key, for example, cryptographic key that's stored in the memory. Maybe they also stored on the swap area. And also you need to be aware of the life duration of things, like, you know, for example, a RAM memory, it's a very short duration, like 10 nanoseconds. If you go to, for example, hard drive, it's years, right? So you can still have the hard drive, you know, from 20 years ago that you plug in and, you know, it works without problem. There might be some problems maybe with electronics that it will just, you know, produce the smoke, but usually, you know, the platters inside the hard drive is quite susceptible to the environmental influence. So it depends on the date, and depends on the technology, depends on the device, and where in the device. So what can affect, you know, the collection is if the systems are live and running. If you go, for example, to organization and you have the open office area, and then you have tens of laptops running, and then you have a suspicion that there was a malware infection in one of the laptops. Of course, it's not that easy, you know, to turn it off. Then you need to develop the approach strategy, how you approach the laptop. If you have the PIN code, for example, the password, you unlock it, and then you look for the traces of malware. And then probably if it's a malware, then you isolate, you wipe everything, you restore backup if it hasn't been infected, and then it's good to go. Another aspect is the communication. So the communication means that, you know, we have, for example, Wi-Fi, we have Bluetooth, most of the common protocols, TCP/IP on the Ethernet, gigabit Ethernet. But sometimes you'll face the challenge because what if a particular device using some kind of new technology like Zigbee, LoRaWAN, for example, IQRF, so you don't really have, you know, access to the full stack of the technology, and then you need to create your own scripts to analyze. And the challenge with cloud, I mean, it's a common thing. You can Google for cloud forensics, and you'll get, you know, a lot of articles, a lot of resources, but normally it's not that easy to do the full-scale cloud forensics. First of all, the cloud provider might not have data in your country, and the country that the data is stored might not have any kind of cooperation agreement with, for example, the country that you're requesting from. It also might be that the data are scattered, like one piece of data in one country, another piece of data in another country, of course, not possible to reconstruct. Another problem that, you know, it might be that it's a shared service. So there is no dedicated hard drive that can be extracted. It's just a piece of virtual machine that is stored on the cloud platform. So there are a lot of challenges. It's easy if you just have the laptop that laying like this. You take out the hard drive, you get unencrypted Windows partition like NTFS. You get all the data. You find the MD5 hash, some of the virus, and then it technically cracks the case that somebody got infected. Unfortunately, it's not like this. And in reality, there are a lot of work related to the fact that all these live technologies, clouds, platform, like running, like for example, you need a Dropbox application to access the files that are in the cloud. You cannot just open any kind of laptop without Dropbox application or a browser to access the data in the cloud. And then the chain of custody. What's the, the computer, for example? It's easy when you have the physical laptop. You can describe it. You can, extract all possible information about hard drive, characteristics of the hard drive. But what if it's a cloud? And the cloud, in the cloud, you have maybe a virtual disk that's been running and connected to the compute infrastructure. So it might be a very complex case, and in some cases it's not possible to extract data from there at all in a way that you can validate that having MD5 hash sum in the beginning and then some hours later is the same data. Now examination. So examination is the preparation when you get to access the data carriers, and also you get access to the specific environment. For example, it can be volumes on the hard drive. Need to identify the potential evidences, right? I don't know if the person has some FIFA game or Game of Thrones movies collection on the hard drive. We don't really need this, and we know that that's not something that we look for most likely because it's irrelevant. But we have maybe some accounts, email clients installed, email application installed. We have the browser information, access history, so everything that can be relevant and then can be analyzed and presented in the court of law. So that's why it's important to narrow down the scope of the analysis before we start the analysis. So we need to understand what are the things that we are looking and what are the things that we know are not relevant. Like if it's an economic crime, we need to look for the spreadsheets, we need to look for some office programs, we need to look for some reports. So it's just a general problem, too much data. It's not always easy to examine all of this data. So that's why if you're using Autopsy, you will see a lot of tools, a lot of plugins that you can use to kind of simplify your life when looking for the files. And they have different types of, flags that you can set. For example, an interesting file, a suspicious file, the file that has a hit from the known to be malicious files. For example, you can attach also some external information that, like you have a set of files that you're looking, that you know that if the person has those files on the computer, then the person was the one who hacked the organization and downloaded the files. So you can kind of customize it in different ways in order to reduce this amount of work. And of course, you know, all type of sorting and all type of filtering mechanisms. You can filter according to size. You can filter according to last accessed files. You can filter according to last created files, you know, depending on the file system, of course. And then you can also mark those that, for example, support the hypothesis. It can be, for example, in case of crime like Deming, exonerating, relevant, interesting. Incident must have, should have, nice to have. So depending on the relevance of the file, you can, you know, put it together and then you can upload. Another interesting thing about tools like, for example, Autopsy, Celebrite, that to some extent they allow a teamwork. It means that it might be, you know, work on the same computer. It might be a work on the, let's say, organization scale where in the police office they have people working, for example, from different laptops, but they have centralized server and they can actually work and analyze data from the particular case themselves. So, you know, if two or three people working on the same case, they find some interesting clues, they can distribute the load, they can divide what the files that they're looking for, so it's usually very efficient. So it means that, you know, there are ways to optimize work of the police. And of course, it's important to prioritize, like, what kind of things. So it means that, you know, those who collected and responded in the first place, they need to put things in the report and they need to communicate. All right, we think that there was a Wi-Fi spot. We think maybe a computer connected to a Wi-Fi in the, you know, in the nearby cafe or the restaurant or something. So it needs to be a context given before, you know, we start, because the hypothesis will be influenced by this context. And the context also will influence, like, what kind of things we are looking for: spreadsheet, images, I don't know, program files, for example, viruses, anything. So it's very important to narrow down this kind of data. And sometimes metadata are important. So sometimes, you know, you'll get some clues from the metadata, but not from the files itself. Like, for example, when the file was downloaded, maybe the file is not relevant at all, but we can see that the file was downloaded maybe when the attack occurred. So it's something that can be considered. So I mentioned in this lecture the abstraction, right? So different abstraction, we have the file systems, we have the volumes, different types of volumes, we have and different types of you know, computers that can use the hard drives. But it's also related to the fact that sometimes files will be corrupted. Sometimes you have the files that need specific software to open these files. Sometimes you'll need to employ, for example, decryption or archiving mechanisms to open the files. In some of the cases, the files are deleted, so you cannot see them. But if you do bit by bit copy and open the copy or the image in Autopsy, you will see that, you know, we have these files marked with red that were deleted, and you still technically can extract them. Tools like TestDisk on Linux, it's a free tool. You also can restore and you know, carve a lot of files from the file system. And the triage, how many of you heard about the triage? Perfect. So it's also something that you learn in the malware reverse engineering course. The approach where, you know, you're trying to narrow down the scope and you're trying to narrow down the type of data that you're looking for, maybe infection, maybe attack. And it's based on, you know, available information, based on your experience, based on the threat landscape, and based on the vulnerabilities of the tools that you have on your laptop, and so on. So carving, it's not one specific method, but this is largely a set of tools and set of methods that help to extract the data from the files that have been deleted. Like, they can be, you know, that somebody just checked the laptop and, you know, the head hit the platter, and you'll get some kind of dust and some of the files, like, you know, erased and modified. It can be also that somebody intentionally deleted the files and at some point, you know, overwrote the disk with zero, so you get maybe, you know, bits and pieces of the files. Sometimes people change the extension of the files, so you might see that, you know, it's a document from the Microsoft Office. You open, but the Office says that, you know, you cannot open the file, there is an error. So maybe somebody changed it from, I don't know, SQL database, PHP script or something. So it depends. It's just, you know, a huge set of methods and tools that can be used to extract. We also may look into encryption. This is from the information, let's say, theory. The encryption, how many of you know what is entropy? So the entropy, the entropy, this is the measure of uncertainty. And it's usually mentioned from, measured from 0 to 8 bits. So if we have entropy of 1.5, maybe 1.4, and this is the entropy of a file with English text, it means that the entropy is low, and technically we can understand and we can predict what's the content about, maybe what's the next word in the sentence, so we have some kind of certainty. If we encrypt this this text, or we compress it, we'll get an entropy at about 7.9, maybe 8 bits, meaning that we cannot predict, and meaning that, you know, the information is hidden. So in most of the tools, you will see this entropy search. Like, for example, I want to look at all of the files that have entropy 7.8, and then maybe you'll find some interesting, you know, file names or some interesting locations. So you can also do it in the digital forensics tools. I'm going to show you things like Kali Linux. I have it installed here. But also I will put a video on the Blackboard that I recorded about how to use Autopsy. It's Autopsy 4.18, I think. So Kali, how many of you try to install Kali? Wonderful. It's a fantastic distro. It's very well maintained. They put tools, like hundreds of different tools that are, you know, peer-reviewed, that are popular, and they update it like with every release that they put. It's a very, very protected user, and the password is KaliKali. And here you can find a lot of applications and software depending on, you know, what you're doing. So as I mentioned, this is a distro primarily focused on the ethical hacking and penetration testing, but also reconnaissance and information gathering. So we have everything, you know, from the information gathering, like, for example, you know, ReconNG and map, so we can map, I don't know, network, for example, if we want to understand, like, what's the computers and the network. We have the Dmitry. It's the information gathering tool that, you know, used to collect everything about, you know, the IP addresses, the hosts, and it's well maintained. We have, you know, vulnerability analysis, like, for example, Nico and Map. So we can check, you know, for example, what is the most likely operating system that is installed on the host? What kind of, for example, Apache server version? If it's Nginx, what kind of Nginx version is there? And so on. Have database assessment like SQL Map. Web applications. So anything that, you know, you can do with web applications like Burp Suite. You can analyze. You can run, you know, the vulnerability tests, you can check if there are any CVE available. Passport, like, you know, John the Ripper, so it's also a very good tool to crack the passports. It's, I mean, you cannot really crack everything, you need to understand how things work, that it's a dictionary attack, and you know, you have a certain set of things that you could possibly crack if you know the parameters of the password, like, you know, the lens, used symbols, and so on. Wireless attacks, so AirCrackNG is one of the most, you know, used and popular tools to crack things. Like, you can apply it against WEP. So not the VPA2. It's VPA2 is more complex, but if you have a bit kind of outdated protection in the Wi-Fi network, then surely you can easily crack it. In the reverse engineering, it's Radar2. You can analyze the binaries. You can run Radar2, and you can, for example, create a map of the functions, like, you know, that you can see what kind of function is calling which function. Of course, it's the assembly. You will see the registers. You'll see the ASCII commands. So if there are some strings, maybe, you know, the commands from the source code, you also will be able to see it. The exploitation tools, like, for example, Metasploit. Metasploit is, or MSF payload, is, you know, the origins of Kali Linux. It started as one project, and they developed it in a completely different and more powerful tool over 10 years. Sniffing, again, Wireshark. How many of you used Wiresharks? Perfect. So it's de facto standard, you know, for analyzing the traffic. It's very convenient. You can do a lot of things. You can do, you know, filtering, sorting. You can, I think you can do man-in-the-middle attack there. You can extract, you know, payloads. So it's very, very powerful tool. Post-exploitation, like Mimikatz and other tools one can use once, you know, the access to the system is let's say, granted. Or given, then you can, you know, extract the passwords and all relevant information. Forensics, you know, like autopsy, I'll briefly mention. So autopsy, the tool that is normally a standard package in Linux, so you can just, you know, write sudo apt-get install. For example, sluicekit and autopsy. But this is, let's say, the previous version, a web-based version of autopsy that is used to analyze the data. Like, you can create a new case, like, for example, new case, case name, case one, and then a new case. Let's see if add host one, add image, and here we can... we can put an image, so using, for example, dd command, you can scrape or copy everything from the hard drive, and then you can put this image into autopsy and, you know, extract, look for the files that have been deleted, you know, explore what kind of, you know, keywords that you can find there, and so on. Reporting tools, you know, like people, Faraday start, so all the types of things that, you know, you can possibly found. Also Multego was part of the Kali at some point, so you can, you know, have more kind of open source intelligence collection and mapping of the information. So I strongly recommend you to have a look at Kali Linux. So you can just download, you know, the virtual machine image and run on your PC. And it's most of the tools that are open source, they're free. Yes, and after the lecture, I will put the archive, 11carf FAT. And you'll need to download the autopsy and try, you know, exploring the data, try, you know, looking through the files, try using, for example, a keyword search, and so on. That's it for today. Do you have any questions? Anything? So, as I mentioned in the beginning, if there are any challenges with the group composition, please reach out so we can fix it. Thank you for your attention. Then I'll provide more information about next week.